Welcome to the HIV Australia podcast, a discussion about the community-led response to HIV. In this episode, Heather Ellis talks with Dr. Julian Lau, a clinical researcher at the Doherty Institute and several major hospitals in Melbourne, to talk about HIV cure research.
Welcome everyone to the HIV Cure Research in 2024 webinar with special guest Dr. Julian Lau. My name is Heather Ellis. I'm the Communications and Engagement Coordinator with Positive Women Victoria, and I've been living with HIV for 28 years. Our special guest today is Dr. Julian Lau, who is a clinical researcher at the Alfred Hospital and the Doherty Institute, and her research focuses on studying strategies to cure HIV and improving meaningful engagement of people with HIV in cure-focused clinical trials. Today, Julian will explain the different types of HIV cure research happening during 2024, and these are the viral shock and kill therapy, CRISPR gene editing therapy, and long-term injectable ARVs combined with bNAbs as a functional cure. So welcome, Julian. And let's start with viral shock and kill therapy.
Fantastic. Thank you, Heather. Thanks so much for having me. You know how much I love talking about cure. Viral shock and kill. Before we discuss what the shock and kill strategy is and perhaps around some of the issues of the name shock and kill, which does sound a bit violent, we really need to go back to one of the main reasons we can't cure HIV at the moment. We know that we can take a tablet every day or even injectable therapy every 2 months at the moment and have a virus that is suppressed and undetectable, but we can't eliminate HIV from the body because of this concept of the latent HIV reservoir. And it's really important to explain that because this plays into some of the other concepts I'll discuss. The CD4 T cell. This is an immune cell that we all have in our bodies, and this is a cell that HIV infects. In productive infection or in someone who's not on HIV treatment or antiretroviral therapy, a virus infects the CD4 T cell, it integrates into human DNA, and then it makes new viruses, new viral proteins, and a new HIV virus going on to infect other cells. So when we take HIV treatment or antiretroviral therapy, this prevents it stops this process at multiple stages of the HIV virus life cycle, and it stops the virus from infecting new, healthy, uninfected CD4 T cells. This concept of latent infection is basically when a CD4 cell has been infected by the HIV, and it's integrated, as the DNA of HIV and human DNA has integrated and bonded together. But this cell is quiet. It's not creating new viral particles. It's not creating new HIV virions. And it's what we call latent. It's unaffected by treatment. So HIV antiretroviral therapy doesn't affect this latent process. And these cells are long-lived, so they last for a long, long time. And they're different types of T cells or different types of immune cells that can sit in this latent, dormant state. And this is a main barrier to achieving a cure for HIV, and one of the earliest and still most well-studied strategies to cure HIV is what we call the shock and kill strategy. And this is where we have this latent, quiet, sleeping cell, not detected, not raising flags to our regular immune system responses. And we shock it. We shock it out of this quiet state. So it is stimulated to produce viral proteins. And we shock it using different agents, so different therapies, interventions, and I can talk a bit more about the specific ones later. But shock and kill basically looks at some sort of intervention that stimulates the cell to trigger this process of productive infection. So viral proteins are being created, virally active reproducing cell. And the thought is that if we do this, the cell is active and it's able to be seen by our body's immune responses. And also the nature of kind of virus replicating, the natural life cycle of the virus is that it kills the cell that it has infected. So there's either our body's immune system seeing the cell now and clearing it, or the cell dying because of virus effects. So this is shock and kill. There's been a lot of talk about shock and kill and the terminology that we use. Does it have to be so aggressive sounding? Because it's, you know, we don't want to kill these cells, but we do want to eliminate cells that have HIV infection in them, and keep the healthy cells, the uninfected cells. So I think it's a term that we've used now for a long time, over a decade, and latency reversing agents, or LRAs, are a term that we use often in the cure space, as different drugs or interventions that stimulate this process. Where's the science with shock and kill? So we've done we as by we I mean collectively HIV cure science has discovered a number of agents, LRAs, that can stimulate this latency reversal process. So make it show viral proteins, make it visible to the immune system. But where we've struggled in the science is that we haven't got the kill. So we're not seeing a reduction in the size of the reservoir. Virus is being activated. We can see an increase in some of the viral proteins in the blood when we measure it as part of these trials, but we're not seeing a reduction in the reservoir, or which would be a broad measure of the cell death. That is the kill part of shock and kill. So where is the science going? We're looking at more targeted latency reversal therapy using some of the technologies I'll talk about later, and strategies that improve the death, so the like targeted cell death without causing dangerous amounts of cell death for other healthy cells, but targeted death to eliminate infected cells. That's the basic concepts of LRAs.
A quick question, just about those four people who are cured of HIV who had a bone marrow transplant, that was to treat their cancer. So we know that that treatment is really expensive and risky, and so it's not so practical as a HIV cure. But have any ideas emerged from this area that will lead to a cure based on the shock and kill therapy?
Not specifically for shock and kill, maybe to go to that really important concept of there's actually six people now, Heather, who have
Oh,
been
okay.
cured of HIV with stem cell transplant. So this is a medical procedure where stem cells are removed from your body. Stem cells are basically they're like progenitor cells. They're cells that have the ability to make new baby blood cells, whether it be red blood cells, white blood cells, or the different lineages of cells that we have in our blood. And a stem cell transplant takes a harvest of stem cells, and then people are given chemotherapy, aggressive, quite toxic medications to basically kill cancer cells within the blood, and then they receive healthy stem cells back, which can then regenerate the blood and the body's immune system. So the really cool thing about the six people who have been cured of HIV with stem cell transplants, they needed these stem cell transplants for their cancer. They all had aggressive blood cancers, and they were heading towards a stem cell transplant as a cure for that anyway. With Timothy Ray Brown, the Berlin patient, his hematologist, his blood cancer specialist, had the clever thought of maybe we can find a donor who's naturally resistant to HIV infection. And so this donor, about 1% of the Caucasian population have a mutation. That means that their CD4 cells, their immune cells, cannot be infected by HIV. So that's quite rare, but Timothy Ray Brown's blood cancer specialist thought, I'll find a donor who matches with Timothy Ray Brown, and I'll give him stem cells that are naturally resistant to HIV infection. So that's how, and then the chemotherapy as part of the stem cell transplant wiped out all the cells that were infected. And so Timothy Ray Brown started with a whole new immune system that was naturally resistant to HIV. So it's a different concept to shock and kill, but it's really an important concept because later on we talk about gene therapy, and there has been some thought about can we use gene editing to make our cells naturally resistant to HIV infection. But the five other patients after Timothy Ray Brown who have also been cured have all had a similar process. So they had blood cancer, required a transplant for blood cancer purposes, and they found donors who had this mutation. And after monitoring these people, following their transplants, stopping their regular HIV antivirus medication, found that they had no virus anywhere, looking at lots of different body compartments and lots of blood, tissue, and they couldn't find virus anywhere. So, we can theoretically cure HIV, but with this very specific, quite dangerous procedure, which is not scalable, but the concept is there. And like you said, we can use the things that we've learned from that in some of the applications that we can talk about this afternoon.
Yeah, because recently there's been some research released about venetoclax.
Venetoclax.
Yeah, that might hold clue to a cure using the shock and kill. So
Yes.
has that cancer drugs become more successful in that shock and kill therapy than other treatments that we're using?
Yes, so venetoclax is a drug that specifically addresses the kill part of shock and kill. So yeah, we've actually found a number of compounds that can shock quite well, but the kill component of it isn't really happening. And the question is why? Is it toxicities, or is it, it's not potent enough? But venetoclax is a drug that specifically is what we call a pro-kill, or basically it stops the processes where cancer cells can hide from the natural killing process. All of us have cells, and all our cells eventually die when our hair falls out, when our nails grow. This is a normal part of life, and is this cell death is called apoptosis. And venetoclax is a apoptosis stimulating drug, basically. So it's enhancing the kill part of the shock and kill. It is a cancer drug. It is used in leukemia, so blood cancers. There seems to be a theme here. We're looking at a lot of cancer drugs. And why is that? I think HIV and cancer are similar in terms of they're foreign to the body and they can evade our body's normal immune system. So we are using a lot of learnings from cancer and vice versa. Cancer therapy is using a lot of learnings from HIV. But you're seeing a lot of the drugs that we're testing in HIV cure studies, human clinical studies, involving cancer drugs, because we know their safety profile from the cancer trials, but they're starting to be explored in human trials in people living with HIV who don't have cancer. Actually, on the topic of venetoclax, it's really exciting because venetoclax was a drug that, from a cure point of view, was really explored and developed in Melbourne. So here and locally, which is very exciting. And the early We call them preclinical studies, the test tube studies, where scientists work with cell lines. These were done from blood samples donated by people living with HIV in Melbourne. So it's really exciting to see the full circle of patients or volunteers who I know who have donated blood samples. Those samples going into the lab, making crazy good science. And then we see findings that venetoclax is able to not just shock, but also kill in a lab model. And then at the WEHI Institute, the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute in the Parkville precinct, they started looking at that in mouse models, so mouse studies. And we're about to start looking at venetoclax in human studies now as well. So without cancer, people living with HIV, healthy, on antiretroviral therapy, without cancer. This study will be starting probably in 2025. It's called AMBER. And so watch this space. I'll update you more on that as we hear more.
So can people enroll in that study?
Yes. So it won't start till 2025 probably. So AMBER is coming. It's a study with the science heavily coming from Melbourne, but we're doing it in collaboration with our good friends in Aarhus University in Denmark. So both our sites will be doing this, and definitely there'll be more information to come in AMBER. Another point is venetoclax is a tablet therapy, so it doesn't require drips or infusions or injections. So in that sense, it might be an easier trial for some people to consider, but it does involve a treatment interruption, and that is stopping HIV treatment during the study, closely monitored after taking their venetoclax, because we want to see, well, that we really do need that treatment interruption to see if there's any impact at a human level. We know that it works at a cell line level in a test tube, but it does involve a treatment interruption. So that's something to consider for people who might be interested in the study as well.
And as a cancer drug, does venetoclax have any side effects?
Yep. So all drugs have potential toxicities, cancer drugs in particular. So venetoclax is not the typical chemotherapy we hear about when we think about cancer therapy, but it is a cancer drug, and it does have side effects, not dissimilar to chemotherapy. So the main side effects are people's cell counts can drop. So they can drop their red blood cells, their white blood cells, another component of their blood count called neutrophils. These can drop on venetoclax, and that we've seen in human studies in the cancer world. The drug dose in the AMBER study is going to be much, much lower than what is used in cancer therapy, because we don't need to treat cancer. We want to see if there's an effect on the
Less chance of side effects. because the
Yep.
doses
And
are low. With that treatment or that trial reduce a person's immunity? Because as we know, chemotherapy or cancer drugs can actually impact on your immune system and reduce your
yeah, that's a
immunity.
really good question, Heather. And theoretically, yes, it can reduce certain components of the immune system. Those neutrophils I talked about are a really important component of our immune system, as lymphocytes, which are white cells, of which CD4 T cells are part of that umbrella. So theoretically, yes, we would not expect these significant drops in these counts as might be seen in the cancer world in this lower dose for a cure trial. Where we are with the science in HIV cure research, almost every single study name starts with safety. So like the main outcome, first of all, first and foremost is safety, then tolerability, usually if people tolerate it, and then efficacy, so how good it is at doing what we want it to. So we call these phase one, phase two trials. We might have heard of phase three, big COVID vaccine studies, for example. So phase three are where we look at thousands and thousands of participants looking at efficacy. Phase one and phase two really is first and foremost about safety, and this is definitely the main aim of the venetoclax AMBER study: safety and efficacy at a low dose in people with HIV without cancer with a treatment interruption. It's a lot.
And another question just about the reservoir and how the latent cells are measured. Because with people living with HIV, say like myself, who probably have a large reservoir because of when I was diagnosed and I've developed AIDS, so lots of reservoir, lots of latent cells. But somebody who's just contracted HIV, just been diagnosed, has got a very, very small HIV reservoir. How do you measure that? And how does those people with two different levels of latent cells impact on the cure results?
That's fabulous questions, Heather. So one thing we grapple with when we're designing clinical trials in HIV cure is, do we only target people with small reservoirs because they have a smaller threshold to start with and therefore have a higher likelihood of cure? And I don't necessarily personally think that's the best idea, because then that excludes perhaps people like yourself who've had HIV for a long time and have a larger reservoir. If we want a cure, it has to be for everyone. We can't just have it with people who have small reservoirs who may have had a diagnosis within 3 months of infection, for example, so a very recent infection. The counter argument to that is, we are at that early pointy end of cure research where we need to find some kind of signal. We need to see if something works. And if it works in this population, we can take what we learn from that population to the broader population. So it's a really interesting and philosophical question. And when it comes to designing trials, do we design them for the many because we should, by concept, design it for everyone? Or do we start because we're in the early pointy end with a very targeted population, try and get that signal and then expand it further? Regarding your question about how do we measure the reservoir, that's a difficult one too. So when we have a blood test in a clinic, or you see a doctor and you have a clinical blood test to monitor your HIV management, that test is your HIV virus load. In a lab point of view, we call it HIV RNA, which is a type of protein and some genetic material. When we measure the reservoir, historically we've used a measure called HIV DNA. So similar, but a different measurement, a different protein that's measured. But what we've learned over quite a while now, last over 5 to 10 years, is that the HIV DNA level as a measure of the reservoir grossly overestimates the actual size of the reservoir. We know that a lot of HIV DNA is not actual virus that's able to replicate and infect. In fact, we call it defective virus because it's not able to do what virus should do and infect new cells. And so HIV DNA can't differentiate between intact or replication able virus versus defective virus. So the HIV DNA test is actually, while the old studies have measured it as the main endpoint, we're probably at a tipping point of when we are now seeing better tests, more accurate tests and ways to measure the reservoir, that HIV DNA is probably not as accurate anymore. But it is a challenging area, because how do we measure the reservoir? How do we consistently measure it so that my study in Australia can be comparable to that study in Denmark and that study in the USA? We need to be using comparable measures. And the common test now is a new test called IPDA, which stands for intact proviral DNA assay. So it's still a DNA assay, but it's a bit more specific, and it's it's quite high throughput, and more and more people, I think everyone's using this at the moment to measure the reservoir.
Move on now to CRISPR gene editing, which I just find very complicated to get my head around. So I'm hoping you can explain for us in a really kind of simple way that so we can understand. Because CRISPR sounds like it's really exciting. It's a possible treatment for cure.
So CRISPR-Cas9 is the buzzword at the moment. It's this gene editing technology that is really starting to be used more and more and has demonstrated some capability and success in the non-HIV cure world. I'll talk about that in a second. But gene editing technology has been around for at least 10 years. There were studies out in 2014 about trying to edit CD4, the DNA within our CD4 T cells so that they would have that natural resistance to HIV, like Timothy Ray Brown had. There's gene editing as a concept has existed for a while. The challenges is the main issue, how do we deliver gene therapy? So there's two ways. One, you can, similar to a stem cell transplant, you extract a bunch of white cells, gene edit them out of the body, and then reinsert them into the study participant or the volunteer, and then and see what happens. And the problem is that is take out enough cells to gene edit, you would have to take out all the cells in the human person's body. And the studies that haven't worked from 10 years ago, first of all, the technology wasn't as good as CRISPR-Cas9. And secondly, they just couldn't get enough edited cells to, I think the percentages were less than 20%. So they weren't able to have the effect of immunity to HIV. So the concept was there, but had to be finessed. More and more, we're seeing what we call in vivo gene editing. So gene editing happens within the body with technologies such as CRISPR. So rather than having to take the cells out, manipulate them in a test tube, and then give them back to a person, it's the technology is to do the gene editing within a person's body. So give them an infusion of an agent that has gene editing capabilities and for it to work within the body. What is CRISPR-Cas9? CRISPR doesn't stand, it's not an acronym, it doesn't stand for anything. It's basically a technology where you, at the most basic level, can cut and edit and copy our DNA. So our DNA is a sequence of proteins, and these each human has an individual unique sequence of proteins that make up their DNA. We've heard this term DNA before, and every cell in our body has DNA that can be expresses something called genes. And genes are what makes your hair blonde, Heather, and my hair black, for example, what makes us tall or short, and also what makes someone be more susceptible to cancer, for example. CRISPR technology was discovered by studying kind of bacterial processes. So bacteria in the environment, studied to see how bacteria persist and survive in environments meant to try and kill bacteria. And scientists basically found these molecular processes that were able to target very specific genes in the genome, so in the sequence of DNA. So what CRISPR can do is we can pick a gene. So we know that X gene makes your eyes blue, and we know the exact sequence of DNA. There'll be four letters in a sequence in the pattern, and we can say CRISPR, go and target that particular sequence very, very specifically and cut out this gene, which might make your eyes blue, or in our case of interest, might provide this protection against HIV in the same way that Timothy Ray Brown's stem cell transplant worked. And then the body will, the DNA will repair itself. So the two ends that were snipped will reconnect again. And that's the concept of gene editing. So these pictures, and Heather, you've mentioned that others have spoken about mini molecular scissors. It literally is that. It's targeting parts of the genome by using a sequence, matching a sequence to a particular area, cutting something out. CRISPR-Cas9 also has the ability to insert genes as well, so insert sequences, and it really has a lot of potential. There are some concerns with gene therapy. Obviously, there's been movies in the past about kind of genetically engineered human beings, or we talk about it in day-to-day, genetically engineered animals or fruits, or the playing God by engineering someone's genes. And there is a concern that if we snip here and there with this particular gene now, will this have a flow-on effect in 5, 10, 15, 20 years that we don't know? So could snipping out this gene, which might be protective from a HIV point of view, could it increase someone's risk of cancer or dementia in 20 years' time? And that's what we don't know yet. That's where some of the concern and need for very careful observation of these trials needs to happen.
Not only does it sound very complicated, it also sounds very expensive. So
Yes.
to roll something out like this to the nearly 40 million people globally living with HIV, it just sounds like it's just not doable, not practical.
Not at the
Have an
moment.
institution.
Yeah. So, to give some kind of current examples, the CRISPR-Cas9 gene therapy has been used successfully to treat an inherited blood condition called sickle cell anemia. This is a condition where people's red blood cells are deformed and they don't work properly, they don't carry oxygen properly, and people can get quite sick. And CRISPR-Cas9 technology has been used to snip out that defect in the gene that causes the sickling of the cell. And they can cure sickle cell anemia now with a one-shot gene treatment. One-shot gene treatment costs $2.2 million for sickle cell. So it's a therapy that is licensed, it is approved in America. But in a similar way to HIV, sickle cell anemia, the burden of it is in sub-Saharan Africa. And this is not affordable, $2.2 million for one person. And that's just for the proof of concept for sickle cell anemia. I think there'll be a fair ways to go before the HIV cure aspect of CRISPR can be realized. There was a recent Dutch study published or presented late last year where they looked at this in a cell line, so a test tube model, and found that yes, they could snip out the HIV that had integrated into human DNA quite effectively, but then they found all these extra deletions and missing things and mutations that hadn't happened because of CRISPR, but it actually happened because the body was trying to repair itself. Our bodies are pretty amazing things, and so they couldn't explain these new mutations or these added deletions that were unintentional because our bodies were doing that. And that was in a cell line. There was another human study recently that's kind of ongoing, but they've just presented some very early, so kind of half a year data, 6 month data, where they did CRISPR gene editing in humans, and they've shown it to be safe so far in terms of at week 48, so less than a year. But we're really worried about the long-term effects, and kind of at the moment we don't have the knowledge to know what each and every single gene does short term and long term. So random deletions are a real concern. So exciting gene therapy. I'm super excited about it. I think we've got a long way to go to make sure it's safe and scalable, and affordable.
So brings us to bNAbs and long-term injectables. After I attended the HIV Science Conference in Brisbane last year, I was really very excited by the presentations on bNAbs combined with long-acting injectable lenacapavir. And scientists talked about this as a functional cure, and some of the studies are talking about virus rebound and some people taking up to 72 weeks. So they just have the bNAb infusion with the long-acting injectable and 72 weeks, which is like a year and a half, and they go back again. I mean, that to me sounds like it'd be fantastic, and I'd be pretty happy with a functional cure. What's your thoughts on that as our most promising, promising cure or as a functional cure that's like on the horizon?
Yeah, I think I'd agree, Heather, that broadly neutralizing antibodies are probably one of the most promising interventions that we're looking at the moment. Let's talk about how we found broadly neutralizing antibodies or what they are. So scientists studied people with HIV who we call elite controllers. These are people who, for whatever reason, don't need to have a daily tablet or injectable treatment, and their virus load never increased. So they were able to control the virus through some kind of mechanism. Well, it's thought to be our own immune response mechanism as opposed to the virus itself, but there's people studying that side of things as well. And so a group in America basically looked at lots of volunteers who were elite controllers, took samples of their blood and studied them, and found that some of these people, a small population of a already small population of elite controllers, had these antibodies. Antibodies are proteins that look like this little Y shape. They had these. We all have antibodies. We can make antibodies against certain germs. So if you have chickenpox, your body develops antibodies against chickenpox, and it can, tag future virus cells and clear it better. So it's all part of our natural immune system. But these special elite controllers, the elite of the elite, had lots of their very, very specific type of antibody. And these antibodies were able to neutralize or suppress a large number of different HIV strains. So it's actually one of those names that are really descriptive because it's the broadly neutralizing antibodies. So there were antibodies that were able to neutralize a broad number of strains of HIV. bNAbs have been traditionally explored in the cure space. The earliest bNAb studies were looking at cure, trying to stimulate these kind of working like a vaccine, essentially. So giving people these antibodies and then stopping the HIV treatment and seeing if these antibodies were able to stimulate the natural body's immune system to control HIV without the need for antivirals. And the early HIV cure bNAb studies were not overwhelmingly successful, but there were several participants, so about 2 out of 9 were able to control virus beyond months, 9 months, so a long period. And the nature of these drugs is that they would wash out of the system within 2 or 3 weeks. So it was a lasting effect, but not in enough people. The 2 out of 11 or 2 out of 9 is not enough. More recently, and I might talk about this a bit later, a team in Oxford University are looking at, and Imperial College in the UK, they're looking at longer acting versions of bNAbs. So rather than washing out within 2 or 3 weeks, they wash out in 1 to 2 months. And then the thought is that maybe with prolonged exposure to these antibodies, the body's immune system is able to be stimulated a bit like a vaccine, a bit more. The concept you're speaking about, Heather, where we bring in injectable long-acting antivirus treatment is really cool. So lenacapavir is a new class of HIV treatment. I wouldn't put it in the cure space. So lenacapavir is designed and marketed and currently being proven as a really effective treatment for HIV. And the creators of lenacapavir have managed to make it into an injectable formulation. So it comes in tablet as well, but they can make it into a 6-monthly injection. And they're using that in combination with broadly neutralizing antibodies, these long-acting versions I've just mentioned. And two different drug companies are testing this technology at the moment. So one, the makers of lenacapavir, but the other company is the makers of the currently available injectable Cabenuva, which is the only licensed injectable therapy. So it's really exciting. We're seeing new classes of HIV treatment, and we're seeing bNAbs, which are things that were developed in the cure space, but they being used in the treatment space. And then your question about could this be a use in a functional cure point of view really comes down to how it's used. So to me, if someone's taking something continually, I see that as a treatment. If they stop it at some point and we see prolonged virus control without the need of ongoing treatment, then I call that a functional cure. I think we're not quite there yet with the bNAbs and long-acting injectables because the combination to me is treatment. The studies I've seen, or the studies that are currently running at the moment, are continuous. So every 6 months, people get another top-up. But like I said, there's definitely studies looking at the long-acting bNAbs, with an intention to stop and see if a functional cure is
Yeah,
possible.
from the HIV Science Conference, so some of the researchers were talking about that you would have the long-acting bNAbs with the long-acting ARV injectable, and you might have it for some people 2 years or 3 or 4 years, depending on everyone's individual. But eventually, your body would learn how to make these bNAbs itself. So then it can, as that latent virus is woken up, the body would be able to use its own broadly neutralizing antibodies that it's created itself to kill the virus, to stop the virus.
Yeah. I think that's what the Rio study, which is stands for Rockefeller, who developed these bNAbs, Imperial College in the UK and Oxford in the UK. So it's a not a drug acronym, but actually just a location acronym. The Rio study is looking at exactly that, Heather. So giving repeated doses for X amount of time and then stopping. I guess the question is, how long do you need to do that for before the body starts to develop its own responses? And that's what we still don't know. So it's very cool. We know that neutralizing antibodies can suppress virus and can stop it from infecting new cells or infecting other people. And they're looking at bNAbs in PrEP, in prevention as well, because it's that effective. The two issues with bNAbs at the moment are how long they last. So that's trying to be addressed by looking at long-acting versions and combination with long-acting therapies. And then the other issue is sensitivity. So in the same way that antivirus, the traditional antivirus medications for HIV can become, you can have transmitted resistance, or you can, you can be infected with resistant virus, or over years you may develop resistance for whatever reason. In the same way, you can have virus that is resistant to bNAbs. And so at the moment, for treatment and cure studies, we screen people to see if their virus is susceptible to the bNAb. This process takes about 3 months, so it's not an effective process yet or efficient process yet. So, but there's so much happening in the bNAbs field. I think this is another one to watch.
And with the AIDS 2024 conference in Munich in July this year, do you see a big announcement at that conference around bNAbs and
Yeah, I think the Rio study is expected to present something in Munich or in CROI, which is another AIDS conference coming in early March this year. I suspect hopefully we'll hear some news from the Rio study in Munich. Rio was briefly presented at the scientific meeting that you were talking about in Brisbane, Heather, but they didn't have full data or full reporting just yet. So it was a bit of a sneak peek. So hopefully we see a Rio bNAb study formally presented at Munich. It's early days. There's been no other snippets of or trailers of what we might see at Munich in July 2024 just yet. I look at some of the abstracts, so I might get a taste of that, but we've not done that process just yet, and I probably can't say anything even if I did. What else might we see? There's some data published in the EACTS conference in about October last year, where one of the first study that was commercially done, so done by a pharmaceutical company looking at cure it with immunotherapy. So we haven't talked much about immunotherapy, but a drug that works as an immune checkpoint inhibitor. That was published with some kind of early data showing promise. So hopefully that will be presented as well. That is called the AbbVie study. That was phase two, so early data, and they're running the broader study now. So those are the two main updates I hope to hear from a clinical trial point of view at Munich 2024. But I suspect there's going to be a huge amount of the advances in the technology and how we measure the reservoir, like as we discussed earlier. There's really huge advances in sequencing the virus and understanding where it integrates into human DNA. All of those assays or those tests are being fine-tuned and perfected and made scalable and high throughput. So I'm certain there'll be advances in that, and I would not be surprised if there's another report of a cure with a stem cell transplant, because it's becoming a concept that people are trying to do if they can feasibly do it. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see another one.
Can you tell us a bit about the immunotherapy treatment
Yeah,
that you just mentioned?
it's a good segue. So yeah, immunotherapy is basically how do we stimulate our body's own immune systems to see, detect, and clear HIV a bit better, similar to the kill part of the shock and kill, but a bit more targeted. So in cancer, this is used very effectively for a lot of cancers, including melanoma, skin cancer, and lung cancer. This type of immunotherapy is not chemotherapy. And we are doing a trial here in Melbourne at the moment called NIVO-LD, which looks at low dose, very, very low dose immunotherapy, once off as a single dose to people with HIV on treatment, no cancer. And previous early work has demonstrated that it works as a shock and in some people a kill. So that's what we want to prove with the NIVO-LD study. And the AbbVie study that I mentioned that was published or was presented at this conference in October last year demonstrated shock and kill. So a reduction in the reservoir and people able to control virus without treatment following a single, I think it was two doses of this antibody, so a immune checkpoint inhibitor. And there's another study coming actually, hopefully towards the end of this year, which is also looking at immunotherapy, stimulating our body's own immune system to detect and clear HIV better. So I didn't even talk about immunotherapy, but it is a pretty important strategy that we're looking at. And there's a PEACH study starting up in Melbourne and Denmark again. We work closely with our Danish colleagues. Towards the end of this year, we're hoping to start PEACH, which is looking at tablets, a drug called pomalidomide, and which is immunotherapy as well. So once again, lower doses than what's used in the cancer world. So there's a lot happening, and a lot of it's happening right here on our doorstep, which is really exciting.
So with those trials, people would have to go off their treatment
Yeah.
to see if the immunotherapy tablets will
Yeah.
actually kill the virus as it wakes up, as it rebounds.
Yeah, at the moment, all these studies I've mentioned, AMBER, the venetoclax one, PEACH, the one that's coming, NEVO-LD, which is happening right now in Melbourne and still seeking volunteers, all of them do include a treatment interruption, which is, a carefully monitored pause in your regular HIV treatment. And I understand that can be quite daunting and concerning for some people, but it is very closely monitored, and there's lots of data to show that these short, closely monitored ones, where if virus comes back, people restart immediately, that this is safe and doesn't cause any problems with resistance or the size of the reservoir. It is a component of all of these studies that I've mentioned so far. And the reason it is because it goes back to that kind of circles back to that concept of measuring the reservoir and how we don't have the most accurate, perfect test for it. We can measure all these biomarkers, but ultimately the most specific and gold standard test is to stop treatment and see how long someone can go off treatment and not have virus rebound, if that makes sense.
And while they're off treatment, that would be monitored, sort of like the viral load would be monitored. How often would that be? Once a week or once every 2 months?
So the protocols that we're running is weekly, and then eventually things are stable, it moves on to fortnightly. It's very different. You think about clinical monitoring, you do a 6-monthly blood test, if not yearly for some people. So this is very, very closely monitored, and we have very strict criteria, all focused on safety, about when someone would restart their therapy. So it's fine balance between pushing the boundaries to get scientific results from a study like this, but also acknowledging that we cannot put our participants at undue risk. So
Yeah.
it's very carefully monitored.
And is there any chance that people would be able to do their own viral load monitoring at home? Is that some of the science that's
I've
emerging?
been looking into this for the last since COVID took off, Heather. I've been trying to find what we call point of care testing. So we've all done a COVID rat, a rapid antigen test. You do it at home, you look through a little line, you see that. Same as the technology for pregnancy tests, and the technology is there for blood sugar monitoring, and we're I think the technology is there, but we're looking for a manufacturer, someone who has been able to develop a device that can do this. At the moment, the best that exists for HIV viral load monitoring, Heather, is that you can put the blood into a cartridge, but you still have to post that cartridge to a machine in a lab. And that machine, might be in a central place, but it can't be in your home because it's still a big machine. So the technology isn't there for at home, what we call point of care testing, so instant results. Every 3 months or so, I scour the literature, look through manufacturers, talk to them at the trade shows and the conference to see if anyone's doing it. Because after COVID, with the explosion of rapid tests and point of care testing, first of all, we know that people can do it at home. They can check their sugars at home. They can put saliva or something into a well, and we know that the technology is there. We just need someone to make it. It would make it so much easier, I think. People might be so much more willing and comfortable to stop if they could be reassured every single day that their virus was below 200 or 100. It's definitely a high on the wish list.
And also having like a lot more people enroll in studies, so the results are sort of more broader across a wider diversity of
100%.
people, including women. And I know we've had this discussion before about how to get more women enrolled in
100%.
cure trials. I mean, women make up nearly half of 40 million people globally living with HIV. And I've read also that like women have a stronger immune response than men. And we've got this like 2X chromosomes, which really important in cure studies. So could you talk a bit about why it's so important to have women in cure trials?
So Heather, you alluded to some of the really important points. There's kind of observational data over decades that show that women, have better immune responses. Their CD4 counts improve more rapidly when they're started on treatment. The challenge has been kind of confirming this and understanding why, because we just have less women involved in HIV cure studies. And that is primarily because of demographics, so proportion of people. Women living with HIV in Australia, where we do this type of research, the studies done in Africa are a lot more balanced. We see a lot more balance, and there's less of this kind of 95% male population that we see in countries like US, UK, and Australia. But that reflects our local demographics. But you're right, 50% of the world's population of people living with HIV are women, and we need to do studies that give us robust science to demonstrate that. We are doing some work locally to try and address, are there specific barriers specific to women? Are there concerns or worries specific to women and how women and how can we address those? So we're running a number of surveys and interviews in the coming year. Specifically for women, specifically around HIV cure, to see if we can nut down into some of these issues and these barriers, and how do we break down those barriers? And I think something I've said at length, Heather, is that we talk about these cure trials where you get an experimental drug and you have a treatment interruption, but there's a lot of research that can just happen from a blood donation, from giving time, filling out a survey. So I appreciate that taking experimental drugs and the treatment interruption can't fit everyone's lifestyle. People might not be willing to do that, but even 20 minutes of your time to fill out an online survey, a 1 hour in-depth interview, donating some blood, donating some tissue, so much science can be achieved from that. So you can be a cure trial volunteer without having to participate in high risk invasive studies which poke and prod.
And I just want to direct everyone's attention to the two links. One of them is for the HIV Cure website, where there's lots of information about cure studies, and also the HIV Cure volunteer database, where people can register their interest and be involved in cure trials or just in surveys if you wish. One final question, Gillian. For so many years, I have heard that a cure for HIV was 5 years away. Are we still 5 years away from a cure, or are we a little bit closer than that?
I think I've been working in this space for just over 5 years now, Heather. So, and I've learned to not use that terminology. I think it's not dangerous, but I think it's misleading because it gives potentially false hope, and then it just makes us liars when it's 5 years later and it hasn't come. So, I'm trying now not to give a set time, but maybe just highlighting, like I feel, even since I've started working in the field, that we've made exponential leaps and bounds, in gene editing, in bNAbs. These were all just fresh when I started in the field, and they're going to get better. The technology is going to get better, and suddenly in the last 2 years, there's this explosion of very specific tests of how do we measure the reservoir, which has been a major issue. How do we measure and characterize the reservoir? There's now all these assays that are so finessed that at a single cell level can really describe what's happening. So it might not seem as evident to the everyday person who's reading a news article about a cure from a stem cell transplant, that there's all this background advances happening. So I'm not going to dig myself a hole by saying we're 5 years away, but I think we are close. We need a major breakthrough, similar to what had happened in the hepatitis C world. There was years and years and decades of research, and then suddenly a breakthrough and there's a cure. And I think that's a similar process for HIV. We're learning so much. We're not there yet. Can't stress enough that we're not close at the moment. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't keep trying and we shouldn't have hope.
Just like to say thank you very much for sharing all this scientific knowledge with us today for the HIV cure in 2024. And thanks so much, Julian.
Thanks so much for having me, Heather.
Thank you.